In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
So the other day, I struck up a conversation with another member of the basket of deplorables. You know, a regular, everyday American. She was middle-aged and worked at a gas station. And it came up that she was very restricted on the number of hours that she could work per week. She was only ever scheduled for 27 and could not exceed 29 hours more than 2 weeks in a row, or she would be immediately fired. Try raising a family on that, she said. It turns out this station had one full-time employee and six other people in her situation, all locked into 27 or fewer hours. So I asked, is it because of Obamacare? Yes, she said. That's what they tell us. We kept talking, and I mentioned how the government has changed how they count people as employed, how they've lowered the number of hours that counts as full-time, and a few other labor statistics. She hadn't heard any of it. And there's the problem. The media isn't reporting the problems. They aren't reporting what's actually happening because they are working with the Obama administration and the Hillary campaign to hide reality. And there is now clear evidence of this collusion. When we said our goodbyes, I said, well, it's an election year, and hopefully this will all change. She said, I sure hope so. I sure do. Folks, nothing that Trump said 11 years ago will affect your financial future. But what Hillary plans to do to you, to your family, to your business, to your boss, to your neighbors, to family farms, to big businesses, to huge multinational corporations, all of her plans will have a huge impact on you personally. If you're employed, ask yourself this. Which will have more of an impact on your family's finances? Something Trump said 11 years ago when he wasn't even running for president, or Hillary's plans right now to increase your boss's taxes by 10, 20, or even 30% when she gets elected? Which is going to impact you more? And now ask yourself this. Why isn't the mainstream media asking those same questions? On today's show, we're continuing our series looking at Hillary and her actual plans, not just her words. We've done immigration, Second Amendment, and today, her economic and tax plans. We'll compare her plans to Trump's, and we're going to look at a massive ticking time bomb, the unfunded liabilities in state pension plans. You will not believe what you are about to hear. And then we'll wrap it all up on how the candidates' plans will impact that ticking time bomb. I'd like to welcome Jonathan Williams. He is the Vice President at the Center for State Fiscal Reform at ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council. Jonathan, it's always great to talk to you.
Well, great to be back on the show with you, my friend.
You've been all over the news lately, and it's great to see that you guys are getting some real attention for some of the reports you guys put out there. Always excellent reports, and of course, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. I'd like to kind of start this show with just sort of the overall outline of the current state of affairs on a national level in terms of economics. Because we're told by the mainstream media that things are just so rosy and that we should just ignore the whole notion that there are some 90 million working-age Americans still out of the labor force after 8 years of Obama. And we should also ignore that 1% GDP growth. I mean, that's somehow now perfectly acceptable. So in your opinion, what's the reality here?
Well, the reality is that we are experiencing the weakest national economic recovery coming out of a serious economic downturn since World War II. And where's the growth? I mean, the old ad, you know, where's the beef? It's where's the economic growth when it comes to GDP? It's not there. And, you know, while some people can mask the underlying problems by just focusing on unemployment rates, for instance, which are, you know, prone to many statistical errors, as you know, just because when people give up looking for work, they're taken out of that number. And so there's so many other things going on that it's really important to look at overall GDP growth, which is anemic, and then stacking up this recovery with other recoveries in the past. And it's been a big disappointment nationally, frankly.
Yeah. And I would absolutely agree with that assessment. One of the things that I thought was really troubling earlier this week was HSBC, which is one of the world's largest banks, they were warning of a red alert for an imminent sell-off in stocks. And the analysts had said that the stock market's moves looked eerily similar to those just before the 1987 stock market crash, and given a 200-point drop earlier this week, he issued his red alert. So, and then on top of that, a few months ago, you had a Scottish bank that was telling its clients to get out of the market as well. What's your assessment of the stock markets right now? Are we due for a fall?
Well, you look at the general price-to-earnings ratio and whatnot that's out there, and I've seen some of the better analysts that I follow look pretty kind of just in a depressing way at the market the way that it is currently. I think it's a lot of people think at least it's hit the cap, and we're kind of up there ready for a fall, unfortunately. And, you know, certainly the fundamentals of this economy are not helping it along anyways in terms of our policy environment. There's a lot of things that I'm worried about, and I know we'll talk about it in terms of whoever the next president of the United States is, what they can do to make America more competitive again. Because if we don't address some of those underlying policy questions, there's a real reason why people, I think, are going to be leery of investing in U.S. equity markets going forward.
Okay, let's go ahead and take a break right there. I do want to get into some of the discussions there about both Hillary's and Trump's plans. Stay with us. We'll have lots more with Jonathan Williams of Allen. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, helping you keep an eye on big government. And, of course, the government is so heavily involved right now with the economy. And when you look ahead at both of the presidential candidates there is a very stark contrast between what Hillary wants to do versus what Trump wants to do. And so we're going to start looking at that with Jonathan Williams, who is the vice president at the Center for State Fiscal Reform at ALEC. That's the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC.org, if you'd like to go visit them. And so looking at Hillary's tax plan, you know, if I were to sum up her economic and tax plans, it was just simply tax, tax, tax. But on top of that, permeating her plan is the philosophical and economic belief that everyone's money, but especially the wealthy's, somehow belongs to the government, and that those rich people are withholding money from the government that the government ought to be spending. And I say this because if you look at her plan that says, quote, close the so-called Romney loophole that allows sheltering multiple millions in retirement accounts. And then she goes on to cite this. According to the data from the Government Accountability Office, roughly 1,000 taxpayers have accumulated close to $100 billion in tax-preferred retirement accounts. Well, even though Hillary and the Democrats think the wealthy are like Scrooge McDuck there with his giant money bin, those retirement accounts are investment accounts, which means those dollars are out there investing in companies, bonds, and other such things, all of which create jobs. So am I wrong in my assessment of her underlying philosophy?
Well, you know, I don't think so. And strictly in my personal belief, I mean, I think that, you know, many of those things that Hillary has advocated for in the debates, which, by the way, of course, have got precious little time devoted to actual policy issues, yeah, and especially economy and tax issues. But what we've been able to ascertain, at least from public statements and from debates, is that her philosophy is kind of what Ronald Reagan warned us on the liberal view of the economy. If it moves, tax it. If it keeps moving, regulate it. And if it stops moving, subsidize it. And that's a very dangerous view, I think, for the future of our economy.
Yeah, absolutely. I just think it really wants to shift money from the private sector to the government. Let's look at some of the elements of this. She wants to restore basic fairness to our tax code. She says this multiple times. And she says that she wants to implement a fair share surcharge on multimillionaires and billionaires, and she wants to commit to tax fairness beyond closing those specific loopholes, especially on capital income. And there again, the problem is that by taxing capital gains, that means you're generally taxing income that your income makes. You invest in stocks or otherwise make smart investments, and she wants to tax that. I mean, isn't that sort of like throwing water on a fire and then wondering why the fire is not growing?
Well, that's, you know, here's my view on the issue of fairness is, how about we have a frank conversation as a country about creating a real tax reform that is fair to the average taxpayer, that doesn't reward the people that can afford the fancy tax accountants and tax lawyers to get out from under the crushing burden of our income tax system. And let's have a flat tax. Let's have a fair tax. Let's take the tax code, make it into something that works for everybody. Because while Hillary may complain all she wants about Donald Trump not paying taxes in one particular year or another, or complain about millionaires and billionaires, they're just taking advantage of the current system that people like her and people in elective office for the last 30 years or 40 years have created. Let's Yes. start over from scratch, and let's make sure that the tax code doesn't reward people that can afford just with the accountants and lawyers. Let's make sure that it treats everyone by the same rules, but it keeps taxes low, and it's a simple system where we don't waste millions and millions of hours just on compliance costs.
Yes, and she talks about that, too, about shutting down the private tax system for the wealthiest. And like you say, those are the ones that have the access to the some of the best tax attorneys out there, and so they're not going to pay as much in taxes, thanks to the, so many of the loopholes that, that she helped put in, into place. Repatriation is a big issue for both sides, and this is where companies that have overseas operations and they're selling things overseas, they're taxed in those countries and oftentimes at a much lower rate. And so they leave the money there. So she wants to then close that and then force them to reinvest in America. Have you had a chance to look at those particular issues on her tax plan?
Well, and this is nothing new, right? I mean, folks in Congress have been bringing in the CEOs for years now, and how dare you decide to move from out of the United States and this whole inversion debate that's gone on across the country over the last few years. And we've seen, you know, iconic American companies like Burger King, for instance, become Canadian companies. And we've seen multiple companies move to Ireland and other countries in Europe for lower taxes. And you know what? It gets down back down to economics 101, Mark, and that is when you tax something, you get less of it. When you tax something less, you get more of it. And when the United States has the highest business taxes in the industrialized world today, should there be any surprise to anyone with a rational outlook on life that more companies are looking to move overseas than stay in America? Let's just make it an equal playing field to get companies to stay here. You know, what it might take is, you know, I don't know, 25 or 20% corporate rate down from the 35 that we have today to keep people here, and maybe even attract companies from overseas and looking at America, because America is a great place to do business. We've got great workers, we've got great education, skilled workforce, but if the tax rate doesn't make sense, you know, we've got to give people an incentive to come back or stay here.
That's right. So she says that she's going to close tax loopholes like inversions, like you mentioned there, that reward companies for shifting profits and jobs overseas. She will charge an exit tax for companies leaving the U.S. to settle up on their untaxed foreign earnings. So am I reading that? She basically wants to tax earnings overseas at the higher U.S. rates?
Yeah, and you'd have to look at kind of the legality of that, or creating some sort of an exit tax. I mean, that would be horrible when you look at the overall outlook on things. But, you know, absolutely, that's the complete wrong way to look about it. You can look at this issue in two ways. Is you can try to make it as painful as possible for people to leave, which kind of skirts the line on good policy, certainly, and maybe even legality. Or you can take the approach of, let's just make America the most competitive place to do business.
That's
regardless
right.
of your form of business. Let's not pick winners and losers and pick special companies that we think will do well here. Let's open it up to everybody. Because at the end of the day, I am convinced, like I said earlier, that if America is allowed to compete on an equal playing field with the rest of the world, we will win. And we just need to get that tax hurdle out of the way.
Yes. It does remind me very much of something that happened in New York. Back when the internet started, places like Amazon and such, they weren't charging sales tax to New York residents because Amazon wasn't based in New York. So New York State then threatened their own taxpayers and added a line on their income tax form for people to add up what they should have paid in taxes for daring to buy something from another state that did not have sales tax. And they even warned people that if they didn't think that you were paying as much as you ought to have, they were going to go through your credit card bills. And so it sounds like she's essentially doing that same thing here with these corporations.
It's basically tax harmonization. You're trying to get away from tax competition, right? And the thing that makes kind of the free market system work at the state level, and why states compete against each other, and why in rich states, poor states, we always talk about the low tax states out-competing and outperforming the high tax states, is that there's this ability to compete, and that high costs jurisdictions are penalized because of their costs, and low tax jurisdictions are rewarded, and companies and individuals continue to vote with their feet towards the lower tax jurisdictions. But if is in the example that you were outlining there, if that is taken away and there's this tax harmonization that you have to pay out of state or out of country taxes, no matter where you make the money or whether you make the purchase, it certainly takes away that competitive incentive to overall competitive on your policy.
Absolutely. Okay, we're up against the clock here. I do want to get your opinions on her death tax, and so we'll get that in the next segment, and then we'll also be looking at Trump's plan. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. Talking today to Jonathan Williams. He's the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at ALEC. That's American Legislative Exchange Council. And in the last segment, we were talking about Hillary's economic and tax plans. And there's something that we didn't get a chance to, this notion of the death tax. And she wants to actually raise this to 65%. That would be the highest rate since the 1980s. This will kill family farms and businesses because, and not only that, but even if you just want to pass along your house, or other cash and such things to your children. This is not just something for the wealthy, but it will certainly be a killer for small business sectors and farming. So what are your thoughts on all of that?
Well, it's clear the death tax is one of the most damaging forms of taxes out there that government can use to collect revenue. You look at what it brings in for the federal treasury. I think most recent year available, the federal death tax only brought in $21 billion, hardly moves a needle in a $4 trillion federal budget, right? So we're talking about a minuscule amount, and it's really not done for the revenue. It's done for the class warfare, unfortunately. So many people that advocate for the death tax just want to soak the rich. They don't understand the unintended consequences of those policies, which you alluded to, which is the stifling effect on small business and farms and ranches, and what it means that these small businesses have been in families for many decades, in fact, you know, perhaps generations, are forced to liquidate many times to pay the death tax bill because they don't have the liquidity to pay the tax man. It's bad enough when you're suffering through the loss of a loved one, trying to then to try to navigate the with the tax man and with accountants and lawyers. You know, and that's why Americans fundamentally think that the death tax is an unfair tax. You look at polling on taxation, and some of the most unpopular forms of taxes, the three most, are gas taxes, property taxes, for other reasons. But the death tax is one because people know it's an immoral tax. It's a tax on income that's been taxed two or three or more times already throughout the life of that individual, and it hits people when they're down. And it's just un-American.
That's right. Yeah, I'd have to agree with that. Let's shift now to Trump. I think in many respects, Trump's plan is the exact opposite of Hillary's tax and economic plans on a philosophical basis. As I mentioned, Hillary's plan shifts money from the private sector to government. Trump's plan, as I see it, shifts money from the government to the private sector, and in doing so, frees up money for investments and job creation. Would you agree with that overall assessment?
Well, from what I've seen, and I'm no expert on all the details of the plan, but I know my friend Steve Moore has been advising the campaign, and you know, people like that give me confidence that some of these ideas would be moving in the direction of free markets and more lower taxes in terms of the overall marginal rates, both on business and individual, as well as things like eliminating the death tax, which has been a long time need at the federal level. And so generally, I think the philosophy is lower taxes, let's have tax cuts, let's get the economy going again, versus kind of the approach of let's raise taxes on people that we think are needing to be targeted, and let's try to play the game of lowering taxes on certain segments of the population that we might be able to incentivize, because I don't know. That's a good question. Why do you pick winners and losers through the tax code? But I think that's really the two big differences between what we're seeing out there today.
Yeah, I'd have to agree. He does say that the greatest percentage reduction in tax bills will go to working and middle-class taxpayers. A married couple earning $50,000 with two children would get a 35% tax reduction. $75,000 per year, you'd get a 30%. And then way up at the upper end, couples earning $5 million per year would get only a 3% reduction in their tax bills. What are your thoughts on that approach?
You know, it's the issue of tax reform gets so politicized so quickly, whether you're talking about it at the state level or the national level, and just based on who pays the greatest share of taxes today, regardless of how you go about cutting taxes, almost by definition, a huge percentage of the tax cuts will go to those making up above a certain income level. So it's very easy for opponents of tax cuts to just say, well, this is a tax cut for the rich. I mean, they said that about the George W. Bush tax cuts, 2001 and 2003. Yet you look at the overall progressivity of the code went up after the tax cuts were enacted because of the child care tax credits and things like that that were included. So regardless of what the actual plan says, opponents of the plan will always criticize it by saying it's a tax cut for the rich. I mean, they've poll tested that, they've focus grouped it, they know that they try to divide and conquer that way to stop tax cuts. And so, you know, I guess I'd have to take the campaign's word for it in terms of how the distribution breaks out. But regardless of how that actually works, the opponents are going to say this is a tax cut for the wealthy. I think the distribution that the campaign's put out shows elsewhere.
Yeah, it would seem to, for sure. And again, I think any tax cut on anyone at any level is a good thing, because that means they have more of their own money. And that's the basis of the market, is you empower people to spend their own money and make those buying decisions that a government bureaucrat would never be able to make efficiently.
Well, that's right. And during the debate, you know, Hillary had that very, very well-rehearsed line about trumped-up, trickle-down economics.
Yes.
You could tell it was practiced just once or twice. And that's the thing, is that people throw terms like that out, but they try to muddy the waters with things like voodoo economics or trumped-up, trickle-down or things like that. But the bottom line is, you're exactly right, is that a dollar in the private sector is always going to be a more productive dollar than a dollar in the public sector.
That's right. Well, you know, you can memorize focus group lines all you want, but the reality is you can't memorize good decision-making. Huge reduction in corporate taxes there on the Trump plan. The plan lowers the business tax rate to 15%, which is way down from the current business rate of 35%. That's, as we said earlier, was one of the highest in the world, if not the highest in the world. And so that, the intention of that, of course, is to make domestic investment more attractive. Your thoughts on that? Is that low enough, or should you look at it even going lower?
I think it's low enough to stop the bleeding, or at least stop the hemorrhaging. But instead of, you know, treating the symptom of the disease, which a lot of folks on the left here in Washington want to do by trying to stop people from exiting the country, you know, this is treating the root problem of the disease, and that is the uncompetitive nature of our tax system. Not only is it the rate, it's that we tax worldwide earnings at the United States rate for United States firms. And so it puts them at a further disadvantage against their foreign competitors. And so getting that rate down to 15% is a great start. I think there's been some good work out there, because the corporate income tax is another one, like the death tax, that raises a very small percentage of overall federal revenue. Just like at the state level, corporate income taxes raise very small percentages of state budgets. And so going down to zero, I think you could certainly have some Laffer curve effect of supply side feedback, where you're going to see a huge uptick in economic activity, which you're not going to lose the amount of revenue that static forecasts would suggest.
Just real quick, we only got about a minute here with you, that he does include a 10% tax on repatriation. Hillary's plan includes a low tax on repatriation, but as I understand it, in order to get that, you have to invest at least some of those funds into a government infrastructure bank. Are there any strings attached on Trump's repatriation?
Well, I don't know, to be honest with you, the details of the strings on that. I do worry about strings in general, though, and certainly forcing companies to invest in anything, really, just as a favor to get money back into the country seems like a gimmick to me.
Yeah.
And once again, it seems like it's treating the symptom of the disease rather than the disease itself.
Right.
Let's get away from this worldwide taxation of income for U.S. firms, and then we all of a sudden don't have this issue of repatriation and forcing companies to jump through hoops.
Yeah, I think that's the exact right way to look at that. Okay, everyone stay with us. Coming up, there is a ticking time bomb, unfunded liabilities. And welcome back. We're talking about economics and taxation plans. Not always the most fun thing to talk about on the radio. We need charts and all that sometimes, it seems. But it is something certainly far more important than something mean that Donald Trump said 11 years ago. And we're talking with Jonathan Williams of ALEC, that's American Legislative Exchange Council. Their mission is to discuss, develop, and disseminate model public policies that expand free markets, promote economic growth, limit the size of government, and preserve individual liberty. All admirable goals, as far as I'm concerned. So you guys have a new report out that, I have to be honest, I could not even get past the first sentence of it without my head kind of exploding here. It's a new report, and we'll link it up on iSpyRadio.com. Unaccountable and Unaffordable 2016. In it, you guys are talking about the unfunded liabilities, and I'll just read you that first sentence. State public pension plans are now underfunded by nearly $5.6 trillion, an increase of almost $900 billion from State Budget Solutions' last comprehensive report in 2014. 2 years ago, and we have seen it's over 20% increase in the unfunded liabilities. That's shocking.
It really is, and it's something that every single American needs to be concerned about. It's an issue, as you alluded to, that kind of flies under the radar for so many people. You know, it's kind of a wonky topic, even for a wonk like myself. And you look at these numbers, though, and going up by $900 billion just in the last couple of years, is really shocking. Now, a billion here, a billion there, they always joke is a rounding error in Washington, D.C., but when you look at the state level, that kind of money is really problematic for the future of the states. It could be big tax increases. It could be big spending cuts to pay for it. But regardless of how we look at it, it's a massive problem. And what that breaks down to is $17,427. $17,427 for every man, woman, and child in the United States. Just terrifying.
And to be clear, these are just the state budgets. That's not the federal unfunded liabilities. If you look at like Social Security and some of these other things, or our $20 trillion in debts, that's just what you owe on the state level. And again, that's just shocking.
And that's just state-level pensions. That's not state health care obligations. That's not local pensions that are independent plans. These are just the 290 or so state-administered pension plans across the 50 states. And, you know, we've gone down by $900 billion, as you mentioned, in 2 years. And it kind of ties into what we were talking about in an earlier segment, which is where's the economic growth? It's non-existent in this recovery, and that's one of the leading causes for state pension plans falling further and further behind because they assume 7 or 8% every single year, and they're not getting it.
Yeah, and I think that is such a huge and an important part because here in Oregon what we do is when we start running up against the wall and people start getting a little afraid, they change the underlying assumptions. So if you've gone into it promising people a certain amount and your projections say, well, in order to meet those obligations, we need, say, an 8% return. Well, they jimmy those numbers a little bit and said, well, we're not expecting an 8% return. Now, all of a sudden, we're expecting a 9 or 10% return. And is that essentially what happens in some of these other states as well?
Well, that's it. It's partially is this accounting, basically accounting fraud that's going on at the state and local level. I call it Enron style accounting. And you know, the truth of the matter is, if you're a financial executive or a CEO of a company and you use these kind of really Wild West accounting maneuvers that state and local governments use, you'd probably be put in jail because it's just fraudulent the way that state and local governments go about it. They're not making the payments that they're promising retirees in some cases, and then they're just assuming the rosiest of economic scenarios and foregoing the idea that there's risk involved with these investments, trying to get money managers to catch 8 or 9% going forward. It leads to some pretty risky investments these days.
Yes, and that I think was a really interesting point that you guys brought up, is this notion of risk. And in order to meet those higher projections now, as you say, they're going to have to take on even riskier investments and whatnot. Is there a real danger that some of these funds are just going to collapse simply because they have taken on too much risk?
I think it's certainly possible if we have another 2008 happen anytime soon. I mean, states are still trying to dig their way out of 2008 because of this anemic recovery that doesn't have the economic growth that we need. Many states lost between 25 and 30% of their entire asset portfolio in that horrible market crash of 2008. And if another one comes before they're allowed to recover with some decent market years, we absolutely could see some of these systems come crashing down. I mean, Americans are aware of what's happened in places like Detroit and Puerto Rico, and things like debt accumulating does have real consequences. And pension debt was one of the big things that happened in Detroit.
So what happens then if a state like, you know, Illinois, I know that they were one of the tops in the past. What happens if suddenly they can't meet their pension obligations? Do they default or do they go into bankruptcy? What happens?
Well, it would be states don't have a bankruptcy provision that's available to them, but it would be functional bankruptcy for sure. And it would mean either dramatic service cuts on government services. It would be a huge tax increase. It would be a combination of both. The thing that I'm mostly worried about as well on the national level is if these states now then would band together, the ones that haven't operated in a good financial way, and come to Washington with their hands out and ask for a federal bailout from the states that actually are operating in a good financial way. And talk about a moral hazard problem, rewarding bad behavior. I think that's actually probably where we're headed longer term. But in a place like Illinois, just to give you an example of how much pension costs have eaten up the state budget, in the last 5 years, out of all the new education spending that, of course, has been sold as for the kids, 89 cents out of every new dollar in Illinois has gone to pension costs instead of the classroom or teacher salary or textbooks. That just tells you that Illinois has hit the turning point already, and there's a lot of states that aren't far behind.
Well, and you even say that even the best state in your report here is it's Wisconsin, right? And that's right. And they've only got 65% of it funded. And that's the best.
Yeah, there's no real winners in this report, unfortunately, Mark. And, you know, somebody once said, saying you're the best funded pension system is like saying you're the prettiest hog in the slaughterhouse. It's just not a good position to be in. And while Wisconsin does deserve some credit for at least making their payments every year, they religiously try to make 100% of their annual required payment, they still have a defined benefit system that's set up with probably overly rosy accounting assumptions, and that's why they get that number down towards the 65% funded range, where by most standards, at least 80% funding is really the minimum that you want for a healthy state pension system. And that is a minimum. That's if you're grading on a curve. You really want 100% because with market fluctuations, then you're not dipping down too low on the funding ratio.
Yeah. Okay, coming up, we're going to be talking about some of the solutions that Alec is putting out there for this incredible ticking time bomb. And then we'll also be looking at both Hillary's and Trump's plans and the effects that it will have on these unfunded liabilities. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show, helping you keep an eye on big government. And we are talking with Jonathan Williams, the Vice President of the Center for State Fiscal Reform at American Legislative Exchange Council. You can find them at alec.org. And Jonathan, we were talking during the break there that these numbers and stuff that these states are facing, I mean, it's depressing. It really is.
It really is, and the numbers are massive for the state level. It's going to take years to dig out from under these liabilities that have accrued over many years, if not many decades. And, you know, there's no real silver bullet to the situation that's going to solve these problems overnight. But what it's going to take is going to take a commitment from elected officials to, A, realize there's a problem, B, realize that business as usual and slight tweaks are not going to get us over the finish line in terms of fixing it, and then C, being open to big picture reform ideas that have worked in some states.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some of the reforms there, because I think if we keep looking at the problem here, it really will get pretty depressing. So what are some of the basic solutions that you guys are putting forward out there?
Well, the good news is there's a lot of really optimistic movement happening on pension issues, regardless of the overall size of the debt. And, you know, I like to always try to find the bright side of this issue, although it may be difficult at some times. I am called the happy economist, so I have to live up to my reputation. And, you know, what we see is states are moving towards, in some cases, the defined contribution model, the 401k model that about 90% of private sector employees have these days, versus only about 10% of government employees are in defined contribution plans. And that is a plan that the government puts in a defined amount, regardless of market return, but it's going to be protected under basically ERISA-type law that requires you to make those contributions versus the kind of empty promises that are made in defined benefit plans. And then what it does is it gives flexibility to lower or to newer workers, younger workers that don't plan to spend 40 years with one employer like maybe our parents or our grandparents' generation did. And so I think it's a win-win in terms of pro-taxpayer and pro-worker, and it's a great reform that states like Michigan and Oklahoma and Utah and Alaska have moved towards over the last 10 or 15 years.
Hmm. So there is some really bad news out there for a lot of these states. I'm just looking here at your ranking, and again, we'll put this report up on iSpyRadio.com. And this is the ratio of public pension plans for 2016. Right at the top there, Wisconsin is 63% funded. North Carolina, South Dakota, Tennessee, and Idaho are round out the top five there. And surprisingly, actually, New York is pretty high on that. Probably not, well, maybe surprising in one way, unsurprising in another one, since they tax everything out there in New York. They really ought to be much higher than they are at 44.9. But then, unfortunately, we've got Oregon, which is 33, I think, in terms of the unfunded liabilities.
Mm-hmm.
That's not good.
No, I mean, there's a lot of room for improvement there. I mean, at 36.3% funded, I mean, that's way less than half of what even kind of the moderate idea of having 80% pre-funding set away for pensions is. So, I mean, it's a long ways off from where you need to be as a state like Oregon. And there's two facets to that, really. As you alluded to, New York taxes everything, so they should be well-funded. So it's the issue of, are you making all the payments that you should make to keep that promise in the defined benefit system? But then secondly, that raises the question of, if you do, how much is that all going to cost? right? Because these are incredibly expensive plans, and there's a it's not a coincidence that the private sector en masse moved away from defined benefit plans a decade or two ago, and they realized that that cost is something that could certainly bankrupt companies. Governments go on with this illusion that there cannot be those long-term financial problems, and let's just pass it on to the taxpayers going forward, and that's a real problem.
It absolutely is a real problem. Are you seeing anything on Oregon's on our situation that is looking like we might at least be maybe moving in the right direction? Because we've had a big blow up here with the whole PERS thing, where we thought we had a solution of a couple. I think it's 3 years back, maybe 4 years back, and then a judge came along and said, "No, even though you guys have that grand bargain, we're just going to toss that right out." Are you seeing anything on the horizon for Oregon?
Well, I know that there's some leaders that really care about this issue, and that's where you really need to start. I know Dennis Richardson, for instance, has been somebody that I've talked to over years and years on this issue that understands the issue inside and out. You know, I was on the phone with Representative Gene Wisnett from Sun River this afternoon, and he has already read this report and knows the problem and realizes the problem's much, much worse than government advertises in Oregon. In fact, the overall unfunded liability is nearly $100 billion in our report for Oregon, using this more realistic accounting method that we do in our report. I think it's been reported at something like $30 billion perhaps. So we're looking at a magnitude of, you know, three times basically larger than what you're seeing officially reported. But that's the good news, is you do have elected officials in Oregon that are looking at this issue. It's been a challenge not only in Oregon but in other states that the judicial branch comes in and starts basically disallowing certain reforms that could be pro-taxpayer going forward. And that's, like I said, not an issue that's unique to Oregon, unfortunately.
No, sadly, it is not. You have one thing in here talking about how the various accounting tricks that they use that obscure some of these liabilities. And I just would like to talk to this one point here where you say, while state funding is significant, on average, more than 70% of the total cost of pension benefits are paid for by the plan's investment earnings. That alone sounds pretty risky, that you've got that much that you're expecting to pay into that benefit simply from the investment earnings. Am I right? Incorrect on that?
No, and that's why it gets back to this discussion of why we need better and stronger economic growth, because absent economic growth and return on these investments, the state pension funds have little to no chance of recovering on their own. Because you remember fifth grade math, that when you lose 30% and then gain 30%, you're not back where you started, right?
No.
And so even if they have good years, they've lost an incredible amount of money from 2008, and they're still in some cases making up for those losses of 2008. And when you rely so heavily on investment returns to fund these defined benefit pensions that are promises basically set in stone to future workers and retirees, that's a very risky situation. And I think that's why it serves everyone better to look at things like defined contribution 401k plans, which by definition need to be 100% fully funded every single year.
Yes, and wouldn't that be something? Okay, we are up against the clock. Everyone stay with us. We're going to tie all of this up and looking at the impacts of the candidates' plans on these state liabilities. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Jonathan Williams. He is the Vice President for the Center for State Fiscal Reform at ALEC. And oh my goodness, if you've been listening to this show, state fiscal reform is badly needed in pretty much every state in the nation here. I'd like to really wrap things up here on this show and tie it all together. And let's talk about the impacts of first Hillary's plans on state liabilities, and then we'll talk about Trump's. If Hillary gets elected, what will be the impact of her economic and tax plans on these states and those unfunded liabilities?
Well, that's it. Some of it remains to be seen, obviously, but hypothesizing a bit is, you know, I think that basically looking at the structure that we talked about, with generally calls for higher taxes, will generally, based on the experience in the literature, mean lower economic growth. And was, as we've talked about with these pension plans specifically, and the economy generally, we need robust economic growth. And the only way that defined benefit pension plans have a chance to retain somewhat sustainability over the next 5 to 10 years is strong returns. Absent strong returns, there's going to be a whole lot more Illinois cases raising up where services are going to be slashed, taxes are going to go up to pay the liabilities. And so certainly I think what we can point to at the national level is we need policies that induce economic growth. We need 4% economic growth nationally, I think, is a good benchmark going forward, and we haven't come close.
No. So let's say that Hillary does get into office and we continue with our 1 or 1.5% GDP. What's that going to do?
I think in terms of pensions, it's going to mean maybe next year when we rerun the numbers, it could be hundreds of billions of dollars higher in unfunded liabilities for the states. I think eventually it could culminate in a very dangerous movement to come to Washington as the states and ask for that bailout. And I would hope that regardless of who's in the White House would kind of think through that a little bit. I'm not so sure I have confidence that would be the case. And I would hope that states and governors would think through that and think long term, because whenever a state takes a dollar from the federal government, it always comes with many strings attached. I was once criticized for using the term strings and told to use the word chains. I mean, the federal government, when they send dollars to the states, whether it's this bailout, whether it's Medicaid expansion, whether it's transportation funding, they're always taking away state autonomy. And that's something that I think every American should be worried about.
Yes, absolutely. And looking back at Hillary's plans there, it really kind of shows why she's looking at punishing companies for trying to survive, especially if they're looking at heading overseas. I mean, you have got to chain people to the economy here, and scary prospect. We got about 3 minutes here to wrap things up with Trump. If he gets elected, what do you suspect the impact of his economic and tax plans will be on these unfunded liabilities?
Well, I think you see, hopefully, that he would be successful in a hypothetical administration with working with Congress to reduce marginal tax rates, eliminate job killers like the death tax, and then all of a sudden, I think we would be in a different outlook when it comes to our economic trajectory, when it comes to the market, when it comes to overall GDP growth, and of course, that would move into over time market returns of state pension funds, and we would see a recovery. But I would caution to for states that think that they would just get away with a stronger economy is that defined benefit pension plans, even with moderate returns, are going to struggle because of all the games that are being played with the accounting, all the things that are being paid out over time. They're not affordable, even with good returns. And so even if we did have some strong pro-free market policies coming out of Washington, I think states need to rethink the defined benefit model altogether and move to a more worker-focused 401k-style defined contribution system.
Well, and as I'm listening to you talk there, I mean, even if Trump could get the economy up to like a 4 or even, an amazing 5% GDP growth, there's still so much long-term damage that's already been done. I mean, it's going to take years to come out from under this.
Well, and if you remember, you look at that national debt clock, which is, talk about depressing website to go to, all of your listeners should go check out the U.S. debt clock, though, to just see what kind of huge liabilities we're under on a federal level with Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid especially, but even the national debt. I mean, we have increased the national debt more in President Obama's administration than the rest of our history combined, basically, which is just unfathomable to think about. But if you think and just see how we've moved in the last 8 years on that, it's going to take a whole lot of effort to turn that ship around. And sometimes, as I like to say, the first step to get out of the hole is stop digging. And I think that's exactly what we need, to stop digging and let's start thinking rationally about how some free market policies can turn things around, because we know the principles are true. We know lower taxes are better for the economy. As my co-author always likes to say, it isn't rocket surgery. We know the principles. We know they work. We need to put them in action.
Yes, absolutely. And capitalism, when you install free markets and especially return money to people so they can be making their own decisions, it works every time.
That's right, because freedom works, and the American people operate best under that scenario.
Yeah, absolutely. Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Great to be with you, as always.
All right, thank you, and keep up your great work. You know, I opened the show talking about the corruption in the media. Chances are you may not even heard about the latest round of WikiLeaks, which showed outright corruption between the Hillary campaign and the press, and some far worse examples of corruption. Thursday night, ABC, NBC, and CBS spent a combined 23 minutes talking about claims about Trump being ungentlemanly, but they spent a grand total of just 56 seconds talking about the WikiLeaks. 23 minutes about what Trump might have said 11 or even 30 years ago compared to 56 seconds on the actual facts of what Hillary has done. You don't fix a corrupt system by electing someone from the corrupt system to go fix the corrupt system. Just imagine Hillary in charge of the IRS, the EPA, the FBI, the DOJ. These will all become weapons if she gets into office. The only way to stop this corrupt system is to vote. And to do that, you have to be registered. Here in Oregon, you must be registered by the 18th. That's Tuesday. That's the deadline in most other states. Take action. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.